this number is very close to twice the amount of time that it takes for a zodiacal era, such as the age of Pisces or the age of Aquarius. They last roughly this long. Well, if you take this number by 6, not 64, but 6, which is a legitimate number because it's built into the I Ching, you get 25,000 years, roughly. This is the precession of the great year, or the equinoctial year, as it's called. So I thought, wow, this is really far out. It's some kind of multi-leveled resonance calendar. Oh, and I forgot to say about 384 days, this was central, excuse me, that this is 13 lunations. A lunation is 29 point something days, and when you multiply that number by 13, you get 383.89. So I said, aha, what this thing is it keeps track of the moon on this level, it keeps track of the sunspots on this level, and it keeps track of the great year of the zodiac on this level. All naked eye astronomical phenomenon, not hypothesizing any advanced technology, but hypothesizing an advanced intellectual point of view. Well, so I thought I was finished, and that somehow it wanted to tell me about a Neolithic calendar in ancient China for some reason. But there was more. Popeye had spinach. I have this. The prompting voice said, this structure which you have created, and by the way, some of you who are scholars of the I Ching, remember in the second half of the Wilhelm Baines translation, there are a whole bunch of very ancient sayings that nobody knows what they're talking about. They're so esoteric. And the most mysterious of these sayings is the saying which says, the forward-running numbers refer to the future. The backward-running numbers refer to the past. Well, in the I Ching, there are no forward or backward-running numbers unless you do something like this. And then, look what you get. 1, 2, 3, 63, 62, 61, 60, 59. You get forward and backward-running numbers. So I said, wow, you know, we're digging this thing out. The I Ching is not an oracle as it's been done at country fairs for three millennia. The I Ching as we possess it is a piece of broken machinery. It's as though you had, you know, the main gear out of a machine and you're trying by archaeological reconstruction to rebuild that machine. So I was sort of stuck at this point, and the prompting voice turned on and said, this structure which you've made, which is the entire I Ching running forward and backward against itself, which would place it then at the top of a hierarchy, should be placed at the bottom of a hierarchy. Treat this thing as a single line, it said. And I was calling this at that point the simple wave. It said, treat the simple wave as a line in a hexagram. Well, when you do that, bear with me, folks. Remember, I said the learning curve was steep. However, it's not long.
Can I ask, we have a vote on what color chalk to use?
Oh, yeah.
It changes as you,
from the room. What color?
Yellow.
Yellow? Yellow? Let me see. Okay, well, so if we treat this module as the bottom of a hierarchy, then we want to treat it like a line. So what do you do with lines in I Ching land? You stack six of them on top of each other. So I'm going to symbolize this thing with an S. Okay? So here's what I did. I took one of them, and another one, and another one, and another one. And I said, did I do good? And it said, sort of, but a hexagram is more than six lines, isn't it? And I said, well, what more is it than six lines? And said, well, it's two trigrams. I said, oh, okay. So then I went like this. Do you see how I superimposed the thing over the six, two larger ones, which were superimposed over three? So then I said, it's all right. It said, yes, except you forgot one thing. A hexagram has an identity as a whole, as a hexagram. I said, okay. Good? It said, yes, good. Now, what are you going to do with it? And I'll show this to you, just so you can get the idea. I don't know how visible this will be. This is what you get if you do that. And what it looks like is exactly what it looks like, which is a hodgepodge of crazy lines running everywhere on three levels. And the thing said to me, it said, this is a map of time. And I made the mistake of saying to my friends and acquaintances, this is a map of time. And they said, you know, we're very concerned. Apparently, you didn't get better, even though you claimed you got better. And now, you know, you run around showing this thing to people. And notice it has, everything is in closure up here. And then everything attains closure down here. And then there are subclosures, six on one level, two on another, and the final one on this one. And finally, my friend Ralph Abraham took pity on me, and he said, the problem with this thing is that it's an occult dogma. Nobody can understand this thing except you. You are necessary for its interpretation. And I said, so what do I do? And he said, you must learn how to change this into a more orthodox mathematical object that mathematicians can then discuss with you. And I was completely stuck. And I sat with it for 2 years, because it just seemed, I'm not a mathematician. I had no clue as to how to do that. And finally, one afternoon, the pot was good enough, or the stars moved into position or something, and in a single instant, I saw how to carry out the mathematical reduction of this wave, and I did it. On this?
Yeah, look that way for
me. Well, if you look at it closely, you'll see that because they are at different scales, it isn't that one side is exactly like the other side. Yeah, there are dissimilarities. So I finally figured out how to mathematize and conserve all the qualities of that wave. And I put it into an ordinary Cartesian object, which I doubt you can see, but you don't really have to see it anyway. All this is, see what that is? It's just a one level, it's an ordinary graph of some sort. Huh?
Is that the sum of the multiple?
It's the sum of certain qualities. There was skew, parallelism, angle of approach, crossover. There were about five things that I felt were important, and I figured out how to mathematize them all so that this, which is an ordinary Cartesian graph, is in fact a topological equivalent of my occult diagram. And, yeah.
Each one of those points is a summation of these factors?
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. So then, I started saying to people, this is a map of time. And they said, is it? Well, where are we? And I said, well, in order to know where we are, we would have to know where the end point is. If you have a wave, you have a wavelength. So we have to find the end point. So then I began collecting historical data and fitting curves to it, trying to define the end point. Now remember yesterday at the close of the day or in the afternoon, we got off on what appeared to some people to be a tangent about novelty and science and time and whether it was whether it should be viewed as a flat plane or a fractal or something like that. Well, what the thing was telling me was that novelty is something which can be charted in time, and that these waves were actually pictures of the ebb and flow of novelty. That this wasn't charting stock prices or population rise or average temperatures. It was charting the ebb and flow of novelty through time. And that, como?
Novelty is newness.
Novelty is, how about density of connection? As opposed, you know, if complexity can be quantified, then you say complexity ebbs and flows. I mean, if we had a device which measured complexity, and we measured this point right here, as opposed to this point an inch behind my finger, I'm hoping it would tell us that an inch behind my finger is a more complex environment than this point right here. So space and time is then seen to be a medium with density, densification of complexity embedded in it like raisins or something, yeah.
What are the boundary conditions for that graph? In other words, how did you establish origin and the endpoint on that particular graph?
Well, until you scale it against time, you don't have to. I mean, I think...
You didn't scale it on that graph, that's all I'm asking.
Well, I think what you're—I think if I understand your question right, remember how I said that over here it was at closure? It goes like this, and that's both lines. They're running. That's both sides of the graph. They're perfectly superimposed over each other. At this point, they cease to be superimposed. One goes that way, and one goes that way. And then you start getting this kind of stuff. And then when you come down to the end, they fall into closure again. Yes, it's a thing of fate. Exactly, you got it. Okay.
So what would be the beginning of time? Is that some fall from the Garden of Eden where we...
Well, to this point, we haven't discussed this thing scaled against calendrical time. We're just trying to look at it as a mathematical object. Then what I realized was, if these are part, if this thing has 384 points in it, and this has six, then what the thing was telling me was you have to map the wave back over itself. So you take all 384 points and you cram them into this space wandering up this hill. Then you go to this space and you cram all 384 points in here and you create a fractal infinite regress. Do you understand? Say you understand. You will understand. Okay, so then that was the time map. It was saying novelty can be described by an infinite fractal regress that is contained in the I Ching. Well, now the main objection that I was meeting from people who wanted to lock me up was they were saying, now let's get this straight. You want to revise modern physics based on a pattern which you found in an ancient Chinese book of divination. Is that correct? And I could feel the force of that criticism, because that's how I think, you know, where somebody from some nut piece of data then wants to build castles in the air. And so I created a metaphor, which is satisfying to me. I hope it's satisfying to somebody else, trying to explain why we should seek a law of physics inside the structure of the I Ching. And here's the metaphor. Think of sand dunes. Picture them in your mind. Since this is the New Age, you may even close your eyes if it helps. Picture sand dunes. Now, notice that sand dunes look like wind. Sand dunes look like wind. And sand dunes are made by wind. So now let's analyze the situation. Let's think of wind as input. And let's think of sand grains as bits inside a computer. So when the wind blows, the program runs, and the bits rearrange themselves, and they arrange themselves into a lower dimensional slice of wind. Essentially, wind, which is a pressure variant phenomenon, variable in time, turns into a pictorial phenomenon variant across the pictorial surface. Do you see how that works? Well, now, sand dunes created by wind bear the impression of wind. Lines of foam and beach detritus deposited by the incoming tide bear the form of waves. So what it was telling me was, it was telling me that things formed in time bear the impression of the forces which created them. And I said, well, then what is the equivalent of sand dunes or waves of beach detritus in the real world? And it said, human beings. Genes, not grains of sand. Genes are moved by time. And we, as hyperdimensional objects, we human beings and other animals, we bear the impression of the forces that created us. And if novelty truly does ebb and flow the way wind speed ebbs and flows over a landscape, then the creatures that have arisen in time will bear the imprint of this ebb and flow. And I believe that what was going on with the people who created the I Ching was that they were practicing some kind of yoga or some kind of psychedelic plus yoga thing, and they were stilling their macrophysical functions, and they were descending deep into organism. And there they were seeing the ebb and flow of variables of some sort. And they watched, who knows how long, centuries maybe. And they said, you know, in the organism there is the ebb and flow of variables. And then they asked questions like, how many variables are there? Are there an infinite number? And they began to create notation systems for these variables. And finally they came to the conclusion, no, there are not an infinite number. There are 64 of these temporal variables. And think of them as elements. In the same way that the entire world of physical manifestation can be created out of 104 physical elements, the entire world of temporal manifestation can be created out of 64 elements. And so the way I think of reality, having survived this experience, is you have hexagrams moving on many levels. Let's say you have a hexagram which rules this 10,000 year period. For 10,000 years, this hexagram will rule. And then on the next level, the hexagrams are changing every 100 years. And then on the next level, every 10 minutes. And on the next level, every 15 seconds. Well, what any point in the matrix called now is the perspective you have when you look through the moving film of these temporal elements moving on many, many levels. You see, they create a unique juxtaposition with each other in every single moment. And that is what the unique felt presence of immediate reality is all about. Well, question? No.
So you're saying that becomes the membrane of the divided membrane between the two realities.
What?
That position where they all come together, right there. That's the place where you can access both. See, I look at that and I always look at the symbol, the I Ching symbol, as the guiding symbol of this plane of reality, bound by time. So you're talking about the exact membrane that is between time and non-time. Is that true?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you know, Plato said time is the moving image of eternity. It's a wavefront, and it's an interference pattern. Yes, it's a kind of hologram and a set of resonances and interference patterns that are created when these waves moving at many levels of expression superimpose and collide with each other. And through the use of small computers, we can explore various places in the wave and we can position it against time. Because what it's saying is that novelty comes and goes. You know, yesterday was wonderful, tomorrow could be dog shit. Same for last year and next year. Time undergoes changes on many scales. I mean, from moment to moment, if you watch your mind, you're going up, you're going down, and then on the daily scale, up, down, yearly scale, up, down, and then on all scales, there is ebb and flow of novelty. And all these scales can be mathematically collapsed into one wave, and then with a computer, you can not only predict the future, which is fairly trivial because who can gainsay it, but you can also predict the past, which is very tricky because most people have a good deal more information about the past than they do about the future. Yeah.
Are there infinite level of scale on the moves? 1 year you may have a larger scale going up, but on that particular day go down.
That's right. That's right. Well, no, you've got the whole concept correct, except you don't need an infinite number, because look what happens. If you start with 384 days and you start multiplying upward by 64, remember I said the first one was 67 years? Well, you only have to carry out about six of these till you have 72 billion years. More time than is necessary for the universe to have birthed itself and reached its present state. Similarly, if you start dividing, you only have to divide 11 times to reach the realm of Planck's constant, 6.55 times 10 to the minus 23rd erg seconds, in technical parlance known as a jiffy. Beyond the jiffy, there is no need to continue the divisions because the jiffy defines the grain of the canvas on which reality is projected. So what we have are, a cosmology of roughly 22 levels. At the highest level, it's 72 billion years. At the lowest level, it's in the realm of Planck's constant. And we're somewhere suspended in between. And these things are coming and going on every level. Yeah.
Well, the way that you arrived at these conclusions I don't follow it well, to say the least. However, it seems to me that you'd be able to use this model. You see some difference in the wavefront around the time of Chettle Hyatt compared to the Third Reich.
Absolutely.
Do you see differences like that?
Yes, I'm hurrying us toward the more fun part of this, and I think that we'll do it now. What we're going to do now is look at the wave placed against history with my end date, December 22nd, 2012, although the machine will accept any end date. And the idea that you should be asking yourself is, you know, this clown claims that this thing describes the ebb and flow of novelty, but does it in fact fit my intuition of the ebb and flow of novelty? Now, here's the good news. The next part of the lecture does not depend on anything that's been said in the first part. You don't have to understand anything I've said in the last half hour to appreciate the neatness of the next level. Lucky for us, eh?
Is that in your way, Charles? Is that all right?
Hmm. That's fine, I think. So now, because, you know, some people aren't interested in this. You tell them you can predict the future, and they say, well, predict it. And then you predict it correctly, and then they say, great. It never enters their mind to ask the question, how did you predict it? Which is what I, out of obligation to intellectual fairness, feel that I should expose you to. Now, let's look at the wave. F. Now, let me explain the rules of the game here. There are 6 billion years currently on screen. Today is over here at 98.8%. This is the last 6 billion years. And let me explain to you how you interpret the wave. And if you want to take a moment and rearrange yourselves, the rest of it is going to be fairly close focus on this thing. So don't be shy and don't make yourself uncomfortable.
Target the end date.
I got it by fitting historical data to the wave and seeing. I had certain intuitions. I mean, for instance, I said, well, if I have a wave which describes historical novelty, by God, it better do well on the Italian Renaissance. It should do well on the 20th century, and it should do well on the Golden Age of Greece. If a theory of novelty incorrectly predicts those episodes, it's a pretty worthless theory of novelty. Once I had chosen an end date, and I chose December 22nd, 2012, I got a lot of support for that by realizing that the Mayan calendar chose the same end date. Now, the only thing I had in common with the ancient Maya is that we both take psychedelic mushrooms. Now, is it conceivable that there is a message in the mushroom as specific as no matter where in space and time you are and you take these mushrooms, it says December 22nd, 2012 AD. It appears so because the Mayans, their civilization rose and fell at a very uninteresting part of their own calendrical machinery. They predicted the end of the world 1,000 years after their own eclipse, and they predicted the birth of their calendar 1,000 years preceding the emergence of their civilization. Yeah.
So now this year 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Is this what the Mayans have as a completion of a large cycle, or is it what they are believing is the completion of all their cycles?
It depends on who you talk to. The Mayan calendar is built up of nested cycles, some 20 years in length, some 240, and there are 13 baktuns, which I think a baktun is 396 years in duration. And most Mayanists believe that a set of 13 baktuns is the complete calendrical set. There's a minority of Mayanists who want to argue that there are greater cycles than that. In any case, baktun 13 will come to an end December 22nd, 2012. So, you know, it was good enough for me.
Now, could you say just a little bit more about the property of novelty? Is it synonymous with complexity?
Well, you know, if since this is a push-pull theory and we have novelty versus something, the opposite of novelty is habit. Rupert insisted on that. I was calling it entropy and conservatism and recidivism, and he said, no, no, it's a war between habit and novelty. Habit means a reversion to a traditional and already established pattern. Novelty means a breaking out into a previous domain, untested domain of new connections and new possibilities.
Serendipity, does that fit in there at all?
You mean as in...
jumping up and surprising you.
Yes, the unexpected is built into it, because when you come around some of these curves, there are unexpected things going on.
What about the chaos order boundary? Sounds like that a little bit.
Yeah, well, you could think of it that way. I haven't completely resolved how novelty should be defined, because if you know anything about information theory, you know that they've had a hell of a time getting a definition of complexity together over there. They also are interested in mathematical definitions of complexity, but they haven't made too much progress.